You're listening to the BBS Radio Network, and this is Between Two Worlds with Derek White Skycloud, healer, author, shaman, paranormal investigator. Stay tuned for Between Two Worlds.
This is Derek White Sky Cloud, your friendly neighborhood psychic medium and paranormal investigator and radio show host called Between Two Worlds. This week, we got a fabulous guest coming on. We have a fellow by the name of Ted Koontz, who I've known for the last couple of years. Ted's been actually was part of one of our good friend of mine, Reverend Barb Leonard's alternative health practitioner or alternative health shows, as well as sharing about healing people in the moment. And she met Ted through, I'm not sure how she met him, I forgot what the whole thing was about, but having to listen to Ted's presentation of what he was sharing about his family and his issue with his son growing up. Well, I'll actually get you guys to hear his story, but also throughout the last couple of years, Ted's come through our spiritual church that I worked out of. I work out of as a minister in training. And every time Ted comes down to our program or to our church, and every time he inspires us, there's always something new we didn't even know about, and he's so hugely inspirational. So Ted has a great background in his work, what he does. And I'm going to actually get Ted to introduce himself and what he does for work, so get to surprise everybody. Welcome, Ted. How are you doing?
Hi, Derek. I'm doing fine. Nice to be with you again.
Great. Now, I didn't get a chance to open my files because I ran late. I got a broken back tooth, and I had to get it fixed by my dentist, so I didn't get back on time for before the show here because I ran late. We had one of our bridges got closed due to an incident on the bridge, and it was crazy, so I ended up getting detained. But I didn't get a chance to open all my programs to get to talk about you and what you do. So if you can share with the rest of the world what you do, and that'll get everybody else's interest in going, I didn't know that.
Well, I'm as a professional, I'm a psychotherapist in private practice in Vancouver, so I work with individuals and couples and families and try to assist people to find greater success in life, and I've been doing that for about 25 years. And then about 5 years ago, I became an author. I decided to sit down and write my about my journey with my son Joshua, which is the focus of my life. Most of the work that I do lately, it's around sharing the stories of my journey with Josh. And so I've written a book called Peace Begins With Me. And then I get chances like this to share my journey and see if what I've learned and what's contributed to the quality of my life will assist others to contribute to the quality of theirs. So did you want me to jump into my story with Josh, or what would you like?
Go for it. No, actually, I would love to. Yeah, you know what? Tell us your story, because guys, you got to listen to this. This is absolutely fabulous how it all turned out. It's totally mesmerizing when you listen to Ted. So Ted, go for it. I want you to share everybody else what you want to share regarding how it became about what you made to decide to write this book, Peace Begins With Me.
Well, the journey begins 23 years ago when my son Joshua was born, and he was born healthy, and I was a beautiful young child, and I was delighted to have him in my life. And then at 5 months of age, his mother and I did what most parents do, is we took him to the family doctor for his first vaccine shot. And unfortunately, Josh reacted to the vaccine. He had a seizure of about 25 minutes long. We took him by ambulance to the emergency of our local hospital. They prescribed medication, sent us on our way, and I still remember the words of the doctor that day when he discharged my son. He said, "Ted, treat your son as a normal child and everything will be fine." Well, unfortunately, everything wasn't fine, and a month later, Josh seized again, so back to the emergency, more medications prescribed. Fingers crossed, hoping that whatever was happening to Josh was temporary and would pass, but A month later, he seized again, and then again, and then again. And eventually, the doctors decided that his condition was too complicated for their level of expertise. They referred us to Children's Hospital in Vancouver. And we began to work with a team of neurologists, and each one of them took a hand in trying to manage Josh's seizure disorder. And so they tried a whole variety of things. They tried a bunch of medications and combinations of medications. They put him on special diets. They gave him steroids. They implanted a device into his chest cavity that's called a vagal nerve stimulator, which runs wires up his neck, and it sends out an electrical charge trying to stimulate his brain on a consistent pattern in the hopes of retraining it.
Wow.
And, I mean, we were desperate for answers, Derek, so we tried anything and everything that they suggested. And unfortunately, instead of getting better, things got worse, and the space between the seizures got shorter and shorter. And such that by the time Josh was four, he was seizing 12 to 15 times a day. And each seizure was about 15 to 20 minutes long, and a seizure of that length deprives the brain of oxygen and causes even more brain damage. And so this son of mine that at one point could walk and talk and ride a tricycle and do what most three-year-olds could do by the time he was four, he could do none of those things. And the doctors had warned us that any one of the seizures could kill him because they say that a seizure of 20 minutes long, a grand mal seizure, expends as much energy as somebody running a marathon. And so there my four-year-old was running 12 to 15 marathons a day. And I knew he couldn't sustain that, and so I lived in this chronic fear that Josh would die from his seizing. And then when Josh was five, the doctors at Children's Hospital asked us not to come back. They said that there was nothing else that they could do to improve his condition. And so they said that if we needed some respite from our son, that they would admit him to hospital, but they would no longer treat him. And so I was left with this sense of hopelessness and this anger and resentment about what they had done to my son. I was living in fear. So it was a pretty dark place I was in. And the crazy part is I would go to work every day and I would work with other families and assist them to feel more successful with life. And then I'd come home to my anger and my resentment and my fear. So it was a pretty hard place to live. I didn't want to wake up many mornings. I didn't want to face what I was facing. Now, fortunately, things started to change, and Derek, you know my story. I mean, I did something unusual, something I had never done before. It was out of character for me, and what I did is I went to see a psychic.
Oh, you did?
Yeah.
And okay.
The psychic that I went to see said I could come with questions, and I really only had one question, and the question was, will my son live? And so I remember sitting across from this elderly woman in Surrey, and I don't even know how I got to her. Somehow she showed up in my life at the right time. And I asked my question, and I still remember her answer. In this very clear voice, she said, "Have no fear. The son will outlive the father as he should." And when I heard that message, this joy went racing through my heart that Josh would survive this ordeal that we were in. And a second question came to mind, and that was, well, if my son is going to live, what will he be when he grows up? And so I asked that question. And then again, in this very clear, authoritative voice, she responded. She said, "Josh will be what he already is, and that is a teacher." Now, I was confused by that answer. By this point, Josh had been reduced to about the level of a two-year-old. His condition was not expected to improve. His vocabulary had been reduced to about 40 words. And so I couldn't understand how he could be a teacher. And I don't even remember if I asked more questions that day. I just remember leaving confused with what I had been told. But what I did notice is that I began to get curious, and I began to wonder, well, if Josh is a teacher, then maybe he can teach me something. And it seemed like once I was open up to that possibility, then the lesson started to come. And the lesson that I call my first lesson was really just a very typical day in our home. Josh and I, for many years, had shared this father-son ritual. When I came home from work, I would drive the car up the driveway, which was next to the house, and I would park it in the carport at the back of the property. And Josh would hear the car, and he would recognize the sound of it, and he would know that Dad was home. And so if he was well enough, he would run to the window at the back of the house and wait for me to get out of the car. And when he saw me, he would yell, "Hi, Dad," and I would say, "Hi, Josh," and then I would come into the house. But as he got sicker and sicker, the number of times that he was at that window became fewer and fewer. And I dreaded an empty window because I knew what that meant. It meant that he was having far too many seizures that day to be there. On this particular day, I drove up the driveway and I parked my car as I always did, and then I looked to the window, and there he was. His little face was in the window. I still remember his little nose was flat against the glass and a big grin on his face, and he yelled, "Hi, Dad," and I said, "Hi, Josh." But I did something different that day. I just stood there and I looked at my son. I just felt this deep gratitude that he was well enough that day to be there. But something different happened, something quite unusual, because as I was looking at my son, I heard this voice, and the voice was as if it was spoken out loud. And what I heard was actually a question. And the question was, when your son looks through the glass at you, what does he see? And that was a pretty penetrating question for me. It kind of knocked me to my core. And when I thought about the answer, I didn't like the answer, because the answer was, he sees a father who's angry, a father who's afraid, a father who's resentful, a father who's in despair. But probably the answer that I liked the least is that he saw a father who was rejecting his own son, because the truth was, I didn't want this disabled child. I wanted the son that was there, alive and well in my imagination, the son that was there before all of this began. And so when I recognized that truth about me and my way of being in relationship with Josh, I knew that he deserved better than that. And so I remember making a commitment to Josh that day, and the commitment was, Josh, I'm going to learn how to be happy. I'm going to learn to find my peace and my joy again. I'm going to learn to fall in love with the son that I have, not the son that I don't have. And that really began sending me on a different direction in life. I began a very intensive journey of discovery, of trying to figure out the source of my peace and joy and happiness. And so it began with a very simple question. It was, is what I'm doing, is what I'm thinking, is what I'm behaving, does it add to my peace and my joy and my happiness, or does it add to my anger and my sadness and my despair? And by simply asking the question and then noticing the direction that I was walking in, it really gave me some valuable information, information that's changed my life. And so that's what my book really is. It really is a summary of what I noticed when I simply asked the question, is what I'm doing, is what I'm thinking, is what I'm behaving, does that add to joy and peace and happiness, or anger, sadness, and despair? So that's how I got to this place, Derek.
Wow. So far, how since you've written your book, you've written your book, what, 2-3 years now?
It was in 2005, so this is year 3, yeah.
Years now. And in your response to the book, have you ever had any people reply back to you, like telling you what their thoughts are with the book, what it represents to them, how they felt through that?
It's one of the beautiful things about writing a book is that I'm constantly getting responses back, either in letters and cards and emails, of people whose lives have been changed. They found some benefit in it. They heard something or read something that enabled them to open up their lives to more joy and peace and happiness. And so it's delightful to hear those stories, Derek, and hear that people are getting what they need in order to live more peacefully.
Yeah.
It's very rewarding.
Yeah, when I was listening to your story the very first time regarding your son, and I feel that it represents pretty well almost every child that we have in this world, because whether we feel, you know, sometimes even the father feels crippled himself, you know, we'll say that word crippled himself,
yeah.
Because they know very well whether their son is happy or unhappy. My son dealt with alcoholism and drug use at the age of 12.
Wow.
His grandfather, which my wife's father, got him drinking because his grandfather was bored, and he had nobody to drink with, so he got him sat down with him, and he just drank a bottle of whiskey together.
Yeah.
And I did not have my son in my life since he was 3 months old, and so part of him also too was angry that he didn't really have his birth father around him, and his mother, I'm not sure if she actually told him what happened, but all she knows was that I wasn't there.
Yeah.
And so I tried to reason with her, telling her that I wanted to be in his life, but the guy that she was with did not want me anywhere around her, nor my son.
Yeah.
And the threat was put there saying, if you ever try to come in near my, you know, come near this boy, we'll shoot you. And they wouldn't think twice doing it.
Ah, oh, Derek.
So I figured, well, if my son's going to be safe, and I'll sit back and I'll wait, and when it comes the time to come in this world, then I'll be in his life.
Yeah.
My son turned 23 years old, and his girlfriend that he was dating called me up, asked me if this is who I was, the father of Jordan, my son Jordan. I said, yeah. I said, why don't you tell my son I've always loved him, never forgotten about him. I think about him every time, every year, even including his birthdays and Christmas and New Year's and all that stuff. And I said, I've never forgotten about him. I think about him all the time. Which, by the way, is my son's birthday on the 22nd of May. He'll be 26, so happy birthday, son. But he came into my life, or 27th. He came into my life when he was 20, just turning 25. And at the time, his girlfriend said, he's sitting right beside me, do you want to talk to him? I said, yeah. And the first thing I said came out of my mouth was, like, son, I always loved you, never forgot about you. And the first words he said, hi, Dad. It was never, you know, I hate you for what you've done, you left me behind. He just said, hi, Dad. And I told him exactly what, I didn't want to use no excuse about his mother. I just told him how I felt about him. But I felt crippled, too, because I knew very well I could not be there for him all those years to be his father. And I thought, you know what, I'll try and do what I can do with the remaining of my life, this life. And since he's seen me, since we've been together and got to know each other more, he stopped drinking and doing drugs.
Wow, good for him.
He quit because he has no reason to anymore. Yeah. He's not angry. I mean, he's curious. I told him exactly what happened in his life, what I had to do, and he understood and said, Dad, I don't drink and do drugs anymore.
Well, his heart got filled up. He didn't need to medicate his pain anymore, huh?
Exactly.
Yeah.
So I feel that, you know, sometimes we look on the outside and we wonder what our children are feeling. And I know what you're talking about. I understand that no matter how we feel, you always wonder what that person feels from their side on that world. You know, when you go to a hospital and you see someone laying in a hospital bed and you know very well, like, for example, my parents, where my mom and my dad were both quite ill. They've already passed away since then. But you think to yourself, you know, one day I'll be there, but I wonder how, you know, you're curious how it's going to feel. But yet, you wish everything you can to do for them. And there's only so much you can do.
Yeah.
And you try to put your hand out, and it's all you can do, and just put that love there, and just give them as much love and support as much as you possibly can. You give them what you've got and all of yourself, and there's only so much you can do.
And
but
it's about how to make peace with that. I mean, the stories that you've just told, that's life.
Yeah, it is. And the interesting part, and I want to say this to you, Ted, and I feel it's very important. You may not know this, but a lot of people don't understand why their children end up being paraplegic or in any certain kind of conditions, whether it's health, what type of health issues they're dealing with. But I will say this. What my understanding from spirit, what spirit taught me, was any child, any person in spirit, would rather line up, become someone paralyzed in a wheelchair, or to be, we call ourselves, crippled in a way, and that we're doing callers. Oh yeah, by the way, before I go any further, we're taking phone calls. Yes, folks, we're taking calls, not readings, but we're doing calls regarding what Ted is doing tonight. So if anybody wants to call in or ask any questions regarding Ted Koontz and anything they want to ask regarding his work, please call in. The phone numbers are 877-876-5227. That's 877-876-5227. That's in the U.S. In Canada, it's 888-815-9756. That's 888-815-9756. And international callers, 530-876-3222. That's 530-876-3222. I also like to welcome everyone in the Pal Talk room. I'm Derek White Sky Cloud, and our guest is Ted Koontz. He actually wrote a book called Peace Begins With Me. And also I'd like to welcome everyone in the BBS Radio chat room. And those of you who are unable to get in the chat room, there's some reconfigurations of the site. But actually, if you go to the left side of the page of the BBSRadio.com, and look on that list, it says how to listen. On that list is how to listen. You go there and you'll find the BBS Radio chat room. you click on that button to register yourself in, welcome joining the room, and you will actually begin to have a great time listening and even chatting with other people who are always asking questions or meet new neighbors that want to talk about anything they want to say. Or if you also have any questions you want to have in the chat room, more welcome, please ask questions. I got both my computers going at the same time, so it's kind of cool. When you have a radio show like this, Ted, you got two people going at the same time, both sides, two chat rooms. And we're working on doing television too. So we're working on the .TV, and there won't be this the show here, but next week we're going to actually get the television program on at the same time during the radio show. So it's going to be a lot of fun to work with.
Good.
And so people can automatically go right to bbsradio.com, and you'll see my beautiful face on the front page talking away at you, and who's ever coming on as a guest, or even including myself. You never know.
Well,
I said before also, when I mentioned about people who are in spirit and those who really want to learn about being loved by everyone, and everyone wants to line up, become a paraplegic person, someone who feels kind of crippled in a way that is unable to take care of themselves. And the interesting part of it is, what I really do enjoy hearing from Spirit, and they've always said, that it's important that person that is paraplegic, because they learn about love, they learn about humility, they learn about how people really want to care about them. Mm-hmm. And you're giving all of yourself away to all those people to be responsible for you. So basically, in that life of being who you are, that person, you may feel that you can't do anything, and you know what, you think about it, when you're in that chair, you don't know what it's like to go to school like other kids. You don't know what it's like to be in the playground with other kids. You don't know about playing baseball or any sports. You're unable to do all the running around, but you get to see what others can do with you. That's sharing. And it's a totally different journey, but it's something that we've always needed to. Everyone has to experience something new. Every life, we're never perfect. Does that make sense, Ted?
Absolutely. You know, I have no doubt that my son came into this lifetime on purpose to serve both his own needs, his own spiritual needs, and mine. And I'm grateful that he is joining me in this journey, because as a result of it, I've grown immensely from it, and I've been able to share ideas and wisdom with others that they have benefited too. So I know now that my son is an incredible teacher. It just took me a while to figure that one out and appreciate it.
You know, I was just looking at your PowerPoint item that you sent to me here. You got, like, you'll discover six ways of thinking that feed your negativity. What would that be?
Well, I talked about how I simply ask myself the question, is what I'm doing, is the way I'm thinking, does it add to my peace and joy and happiness, or does it add to my anger, sadness, and despair? And the first things I notice is mostly about my anger and sadness and despair. And it was interesting to come to the realization that I was actually responsible for all of it. And I came to the conclusion that the stories that I tell myself is what really determines the experience I have. One of the first things that I came to understand is about how powerful our imaginations are. And I recognized that when I was in situations where the outcome was unknown or uncertain, that I would imagine all the worst possible outcomes. And I've discovered that most of us do that. Most of us imagine the things that we don't want to have happen. And I think we have this notion that if we imagine all the worst possible outcomes, we'll be better prepared if those events show up in our life. But what I've come to understand is that when we imagine those kinds of outcomes, that we become damaged by that, that our body doesn't distinguish between a real event and an imagined event. And so when we imagine all those negative things, we suffer physically, emotionally, and psychologically as if those things happened. Research tells us that the average North American thinks 9 times as many negative thoughts as positive thoughts. And so many of us are suffering because of our imaginations, not because of life, but because of what we imagine. Mark Twain has a quote I really like. He says, "I've had a very difficult life. Fortunately, most of it didn't happen." And I think that that's true for most of us. So one of the first ways of thinking that I noticed that led me down the path of anger, sadness, and despair was simply imagining the worst. using my imagination to imagine all the things that I didn't want to have happen. Another way of thinking that I notice is that I would think that I had made a mistake. And now in our culture, almost everybody thinks they have made a mistake. It's part of our social norm. It's part of the agreement that we enter into in this culture. But I was fortunate. I did some work with a fellow by the name of Ray Willem, who's an old-timer, and he just saw the world different, and he challenged some things that I just took for granted. And one of the things he challenged was this whole notion of mistake. And what he did was he asked us to identify the worst mistake that we had made in our lives and to declare that out loud. And so I talked about having my son vaccinated. And what I learned from my discussions with Ray was that at the time that I made that decision, at the time that other people made the decision that they called the worst mistake of their life, they thought it was a good decision, that based upon what they knew at the time, that the consciousness of the skill that they had, that they thought that that was the right decision. And Ray was even more emphatic. He says that we all make the best decision available to us with the information and skill and knowledge that we have. But when we experience an outcome that we don't anticipate, we stick a label mistake on it. And for myself and for many others, they carry around some shame or blame or guilt or fear as a result of that experience. So I noticed that that was the second way of thinking that would lead me down the path of anger or sadness or despair. A third way of thinking is that I would say, I don't want to, but I have to. I have no choice. And I would say that in all kinds of ways. I would say, I don't want to go to work, but I have to. I don't want to pay my taxes, but I have to. I don't want to wake up in the morning, but I have to. I have no choice. And what I noticed was that when I talked to myself that way, I would feel angry or resentful, or I would feel powerless. I would act like I was a victim in life and that things were happening to me and that I had no say in it. And I've since come to the conclusion that that's not the truth. The truth is that I always have choice and that I choose the behaviors that I think will take me closer to what my goals are. But for a long time, I acted as if I had no choice. A fourth way of thinking is that I would do what I call resist reality. I would say things like, well, it shouldn't be this cold this time of year in Vancouver. My hockey team should have been in the Stanley Cup playoffs. My son should never have been damaged by that vaccine shot, or the car accident should never have happened. The window should never have been broken. I mean, I would constantly make statements like that, and the crazy part about those statements is that I'm resisting something that already exists. And resisting, it's not going to change the event. The event has already occurred. But what the resistance does is it changes me into somebody who's frustrated and discouraged. And so I now realize I spent much of my life telling myself a story about reality that wasn't true.
We got a caller calling in. Ted, you ready for it?
Yeah.
Okay, we got a caller. Who is the caller calling in?
Hi, it's Marie calling.
Hi,
from Ontario.
Where are you from?
From Ontario, Canada.
Ontario, Canada. You have a question to ask Ted.
I do. I'm wondering if he could talk about how the family is changing and how it's going to affect everybody in the year 2012.
Well, you're asking something that probably Derek can answer more than me. He can see into the future, and I'm still trying to deal with reality. But is your question about how the family is changing, was that what it is?
Well, I've noticed that within my own family circle, things are changing, and I find that the closeness isn't there right now.
Mm-hmm. I would agree. I think that we're undergoing a profound period of change in our evolution as a species, and some of the things or some of the ways that we organized even 10 or 20 years ago are changing, and we're being forced to organize in a different way. Now, I think we could have judgment about that and say that because the family unit isn't as tightly knit, that that's a problem. I think that we need to open up to the idea that we actually are family with everybody in the world, and we have to break down some of these artificial barriers that have gotten in our way, because what I notice is that we generally take good care of our family, or we have this arbitrary boundary where we say, you're on the inside and I'll take care of you, but those on the outside I don't care about. And I think that if we're going to get to a place of world peace, if we're going to get to a place of doing well together, surviving well, taking good care of this earth, we have to get rid of those boundaries of family, of culture, of nationalism, of religion that arbitrarily set us apart. But that's my opinion for what it's worth.
Well, that makes a lot of sense, Ted, because I mean, people say, you know, I only take care of this area, but I'm not going to care or worry about the rest of the world outside there. But you know what? It is important to care somehow, because sooner or later, those people are going to come around. Like, for example, we had the earthquake in China.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, here, example, we won't get too political, but we have our prime minister, and he turned around and said, well, you know, we're so sorry this has happened, but we can't send anything to you. Because their biggest fear was if they send that $10 million, was it going to go to the military or was it going to go to the people that need help? And so what they did the next following day, which is today, there is 10 people who actually are up there from British Columbia, 10 students, decided to go out of their way and just give blood. Now,
yeah.
Would you want $10 million or 10 vials of blood?
Yeah. Well, and like I said, I think we need to reduce these arbitrary boundaries that we have. One of the things that I saw the Dalai Lama when he was in Vancouver a couple of years ago, and they said to him, you know, is it not justified for the Tibetan people to rise up against the Chinese and pick up weapons and go to war against them? And I loved his answer, and he said, why would we go to war against the Chinese? The Chinese are our brothers and sisters. They just don't know it yet. And I love that how he transcends. It would be really easy for him to get to see us and them, the Tibetan people against the Chinese, the Buddhists against, you know, the non-Buddhists. But he doesn't perceive the world that way. He recognizes that we're all human beings and honors that. And I think that's where we need to step into.
Is that caller still there?
Yeah, I'm here. I guess as well what I'm finding is my spirituality is really changing. And I'm becoming much more in tune and I'm opening up. But as I open up and change, people that aren't changing around me, such as family members, they don't understand spirituality.
Yeah.
They only understand what they've been brainwashed by schools and by churches, so they haven't fully formed their own opinion. But as I grow and change, I'm different according to them.
Well, and you are, and so it takes courage to grow and change, doesn't it? Because in some ways it feels like you're being disloyal to your family.
Absolutely.
And yet I think that if we're going to survive as a species, we have to step outside of these containers that we've placed ourselves into that do us a disservice. I mean, let's admit that most of the wars are done by one religion against another, and each of them think that God is on their side. And so somehow we have to, I think we have to learn how to think in different ways.
I agree.
We have to recognize how some of those divisions actually create our difficulties. They get in the way of being spiritual, of being godly.
Mm-hmm.
That makes a whole lot of sense. You know, I hear something else too. Like they always, and also they were talking about, what she's also meaning too, Ted, is that they're talking about the Aztecs. The Mayan calendar, mm-hmm. how it's coming to a close, 2010, how the world's going to represent itself as fear, what's going to happen, is there going to be an end of the world? And my understanding is that I feel it's not about us, I feel it's actually about the Mayans themselves, that it's the end of times with them, and where it's no longer important to be part of that Mayan calendar, that our lives are going to continue living no matter what it is, how it's going to result, because my mother, for example, I remember telling her one time, you know, I said, Mom, I hear so many of these things about, you know, the world's coming to an end, and, you know, should we prepare for all this? And my mother sat there, and she laughed, and she laughed, and she laughed. She says, honey, when I was a little girl, she said that I heard the same thing in school when I was 10, to hide under my desk, and be prepared for the big atomic bomb, the big boom, and she said that the world's going to go to an end, and everyone's going to die, and there'll have to be survivors, and all. And she says, you know what? It's going to happen every lifetime, and every generation. There's going to be something put out there to put that trudging feeling that the government or anyone out there who tries to see themselves above you tries to control you and make you feel that you are not part of that world. And that you have to learn to come out of it and to just make decisions, soul decisions, for yourself, not for someone else, but for yourself. You are called a survivor. You are given that birthright to be who you are.
And Derek, I would agree with you that I think that we've been manipulated into a a place of fear, and that's one of the ways that we become controlled.
Exactly.
I do think, though, that there is something to this whole notion of the Mayan calendar and what's happening. I mean, I watched the kind of evolution that I think is happening to the human species in the last little while. I think there's this accelerated growth of consciousness. I mean, there's programs like this, Derek, that are happening. And there are people that are interested in it. You look at, you know, Eckhart Tolle's latest book and the fact that a million people a week are buying that book. It says that there's this explosion of consciousness. How I understand that Mayan calendar is that I believe that there will be the end of the world as we know it, that we're going to transcend this dichotomy, this way of thinking. Now, not everybody's going to do that, but I think there's going to be a significant portion of people that are going to begin to engage the world in a completely different way. And so for me, maybe it's more symbolic that the world will end in terms of the way that we've lived it, because when you wake up, you can't keep living it the same old way.
You know, I guess I'm going to ask you, Ted, thank you, caller, for calling in.
Thank you very much.
You're
Bye-bye.
Welcome.
Bye.
How can we create peace within ourselves?
Well, one of the things that I came to the conclusion was is that peace is really about me. I used to think that peace would happen if other people made better decisions, if world leaders made good decisions. And I now realize that that's naive thinking, that peace begins as an internal process, and it really is a commitment that I make to it. And ultimately what I came to understand is that the stories that I tell myself is what either adds to my joy and my happiness or my anger and my despair. And so I can create peace by the stories that I tell myself. And so I've just learned that, you know, again, we talk about the imagination, how powerful a tool that is. I mean, Einstein said imagination is more important than knowledge. But what most of us do is we imagine all these negative stories as opposed to imagine the kind of world that we want to create, live with intention. And so I've started to live life intentionally. You know, the essence of the secret is about living with intention. It's about seeing in your mind's eye. It's about living life creatively, not reactively. And so as I begin to embrace that, I come to understand that I actually have a responsibility here to engage life in a constructive, loving, creative way. Whereas before, life would show up and I would react to it, and I would have expectations that it should be different than that, and so when it showed up as it showed up, I would get angry or resentful or disappointed or hurt or scared. And so ultimately, I've come to the conclusion that peace is really an internal responsibility, and that when I live in a peaceful way, I can come into a room and help to change that energy in a room by my peaceful way of being. And that the way we're going to bring world peace is we're going to grow it person by person, literally from the inside out.
You know, and also, you know, people, like, when I talk about, well, let's put it this way, you were mentioning about the, you know, we have a great imagination.
Mm-hmm.
We learn that from kids, being a child in school.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when the teacher, I mean, the first thing of all, when a teacher used to say to the parent, or he or she's got a great imagination, the first thing you think of is the worst thing in the world. You know, you kind of put that fear right in front of it. Okay, and I don't think the imagination is a negative thing. It should be considered a positive. That's important, I feel. We've got a caller calling in.
Great.
Somebody call in there?
Yeah, hi, Derek. It's Barb.
Hi, Barb. You, Barb.
Hi.
Ted.
Hi,
Mo,
Ted. How are you doing?
I'm doing good. Hi, Barbara.
Uh-huh. Well, you're one of our favorite speakers at the Inner Garden, that's for sure.
Thanks, Barbara.
Yeah, you are. And I have to tell you, this show should go on for about 4 hours.
Hey, Dan, that's a compliment.
This is the best. Mm. So I'll let you guys get back at it. And I just want to say that I totally agree with that we have to have this union of, you know, there's one God and every pathway leads to the same God. So, and we have one world and we all should be living in it.
Well, it's about having respect for one another and allowing us to have our own experience. But we've been brought up in this paradigm of right, wrong, good, bad, and as a result of that, we tend to be at war with others most of our lives, don't we?
Yeah. And the thing is that the fear, anytime anything new happens, when you get a large influx of people, coming into Canada, whether it be the Irish back in the days of my grandmother or, you know, the new people that are coming in today, everybody gets panic-stricken that they're going to take over. And it really is a world of people. We are not just these borders, like you say. So
yeah.
I think we have to look at more of a fact that we're global. We should be thinking of what's best for the globe and not what's just best for one country.
Well, you know, Barbara, one of the things that I did when I would do my speaking engagements is that I would ask the question about how many here in this room have played the game of musical chairs. Did you play the game of musical chairs as a child?
You bet.
And you know what I've discovered is that it's almost 100%. Like it's rare that somebody in our culture didn't play the game of musical chairs. And I find that quite fascinating because when I ask almost any other game, it's, you know, it's yes or no. But with musical chairs, it's so predominant. And so I find that fascinating because if you look at the game of musical chairs, it's based around the premise that there's not enough to go around. And so we have to compete that the strongest, the fastest, survive and the others don't. And I think that we have grown up with this paradigm right from the time we were small of living life as if it's a game of musical chairs where there's not enough to go around.
Exactly, and that's actually the opposite because there's always enough for everybody.
Well, and I sometimes wonder, you know, if we changed the game of musical chairs, if we said, let's take away a chair just for the fun of it, but the goal is that all the kids need to sit on the remaining number of chairs, what kind of skills would that encourage? And to me, it would encourage cooperation, inclusion, creativity, belonging. I mean, and I think that we can change our way of living life by changing the games we play.
Exactly. I think that's great, Ted. You guys, I'm really proud of you, and I'll talk to you soon. So just keep up the good work, and I'll let somebody else call in.
Great. Thanks, Barbara.
Okay, Angel's go with you guys. Bye-bye.
Take care. Here, I played musical chairs when I was a kid.
Well, Derek, I'm astounded how prevalent that is in our culture, and I don't know how it got to be that way. But I see the impact that it has because I ask how many people actually won the game, and, you know, you've got a scattering of hands, but, you know, the reality is that that game creates mostly losers and not winners. And I think we need to figure out games where everybody wins. And we figure out how to belong, how to be creative, how to be collaborative.
Well,
so it's not surprising that we're at war. We haven't been taught the very basic skills of inclusion.
Well, here's one thing, and people call, like, one of the girls, I was just reading here on her chat line, she says she's always stressed out. This stresses her, and she feels very distressed. And then I'm looking at your thing here, and it says, you know, you got written in here the difference between stress and distress. What would you put that? How would you put it?
Well, to me, stress is simply the experience of living life. We're going to be, if you look up stress in a dictionary, it will say a physical weight, force, pressure, or an emphasis that's exerted upon the body. I go outside on a sunny day, and the brightness of the sun is a stress. Distress, however, is my response to stress. It's the story that I tell myself. And what I've learned is that most of our suffering is not life. It's the story that we tell ourselves about life. And so when something happens and we say, oh, this is awful, we're going to experience distress. If we say, this is going to go on forever, I'll never be happy, or I'll never have a partner, or I'll never have enough money, it's that story that actually causes most of our suffering. I've learned I can manage life. If I take life on moment by moment, it's manageable. What I can't manage is my imagination about what might happen, because it doesn't exist.
We have another caller calling in there, Ted.
Good.
Hello?
Hello?
Caller, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
Who is this calling?
This is Tammy.
Hi.
Hi.
You have a question for Ted?
I was just listening to the show, and he does a really good job. Great job on speaking. Yeah.
Where are you calling from?
Georgia.
Georgia.
Mm-hmm.
Any question you want to ask Ted, like, you know, maybe there's issues you're dealing with in this life that you need to ask him something that help
well.
You on your on the, regarding your own personal life. Anything you need to know?
Well, I see that he has particular six ways of thinking that feed your negativity. Maybe he could go a little bit more in depth on that.
on the different ways of feeding the negative wolf?
Yes.
Let me tell you that story about the negative wolf. Do you know that story?
Oh,
no, I've never heard that.
Derek knows it. It's one of those stories that really had an impact on me, and it's a native story, and I just admire how they can take this deep wisdom and put it into simple language and stories. But it's about a grandfather who's walking down a path with his grandson, and after a while, the grandfather interrupts the silence and says to his grandson, "Grandson, there are two wolves that are fighting in my heart. And one wolf is angry and vindictive and wants to hurt others. And the other wolf is kind and compassionate and loving." And the grandson, after hearing the words of his grandfather, is filled with this fear and this anxiety. And he says, "Grandfather, which wolf will win the battle of your heart?" And the wise elder says, "My heart will be won by the wolf that wins the battle of every man's heart. It's the wolf that I feed."
Mm-hmm.
And so what I've come to understand is that we're either going to feed the positive wolf or the negative wolf.
Mm-hmm.
And I believe that, at least in my upbringing, that I was taught very well how to feed the negative wolf.
Right.
And I would do it by imagining the worst. I would do it by thinking I had made mistakes. I would do it by saying I have no choice, that I'm powerless. I did it by living in the past as opposed to living in the present. I would say things like, "I'll be happy when," that I needed things in order to be happy. I would resist reality. So I noticed that that way of thinking would constantly add to my fear or my anger or my despair. And then the challenge was, how do I feed the positive wolf? And what I discovered was I didn't know how to do that very well.
Mm-hmm.
I was very good at negative storytelling. I probably was worse than 9 times as many negative stories as positive stories. And so most of my journey was really trying to figure out, how do I feed the positive wolf? How do I walk a path of peace? And so I talked a little bit about, I believe the imagination is incredibly powerful.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned is that the two tools that are absolutely critical to creating a good life is intention and attention. So intention is, what do I intend? What does success look like? What outcome do I want to have happen? Because what I've discovered is, unless I can declare what success is, I can't get there. I do lots of work with couples that are struggling in their relationships, and they typically would come into my office and sit down on my couch and tell me how awful their husband is or how awful their wife is.
Mm-hmm.
And for many years, I would listen to those stories, but what I began to recognize is they didn't get better when they would spend all of their energy telling me how awful things were.
Right.
So I started to change the way I worked, and when they would start to tell me how awful things were, I would put up my hand and I would say, "Well, I'm not really interested in that." And they would be confused, and they'd say, "Well, isn't that why we're here?"
Mm-hmm.
And I would say, "Well, that's not how I work. Let me tell you how I work. The conversation I want to have with you is, tell me about what success looks like. Tell me what a successful relationship looks like from your perspective." And what do you think happens when I ask that question? Silence.
Yes, I was going to say the silence.
You know, usually what happens is one turns to the other and says, "You go first."
Mm-hmm.
And I what I see is that if I say, "Tell me what's wrong," most people can talk until they're exhausted.
Mm-hmm.
But when I say, "Describe success for me," most people struggle.
Mm-hmm.
And what I've learned, until you can declare success, until you know what it is, you can't get there. And so I live my life with intention. You know, before I make a phone call, before I write a letter, before I, you know, put my feet on the floor in the morning, what's my intention? What does success look like?
Mm-hmm.
So intention is really important. Attention is, what am I looking at? What am I focused on? Am I looking at the part of the world that's half empty or the part that's half full?
Mm-hmm.
And you know, we've learned from quantum physics that everything in the universe is energy, and
right.
even our thoughts are energy.
Mm-hmm.
And so when we place our thought on something, we energize it.
Right.
And what I realized, I spent most of my life looking at the empty parts of my son. I looked at all the things he couldn't do. And when I did that, he suffered and I suffered.
Mm-hmm.
And so now I consciously focus my attention on my son or on other people. What is their gift? What is their contribution? What do they bring to this world that is of value?
Yeah, the good thing. Right.
Well, and I believe that we're all here for a purpose. We're all here for a reason.
Mm-hmm.
And when I begin to trust that that's the case, I find that I open up to people and touch what I believe is their divinity, and sometimes even help them to see their own divinity when they can't see it, because I'm looking for it. Some other things that I've done is that I learned to ask the question, what would do the most good? I had a situation with my daughter many years ago when she was 14, and instead of coming home at 10 o'clock at night, she came home at 4 o'clock in the morning, and I remember being angry for those 6 hours and thinking about all the things I was going to say to her when she got home.
Mm-hmm.
And most of it was about my anger or my hurt or my disappointment or my resentment. And that voice showed up again and said, well, what would do the most good? And again,
right.
It was one of those times in my life that it kind of knocked me over because I realized I never consciously asked that question, what would do the most good?
Mm-hmm.
What I would do is whatever emotion was the most intense, that's how I would behave. So if I was angry, I would be angry. If
right.
I was hurt, I'd be hurt.
Yeah.
And when I asked myself that question, I got different answers. And the answer was, what would do the most good is to express my gratitude that my daughter was home safe.
Mm-hmm.
And remind her that I loved her.
Yeah, very
and so when she came in the door, I did that, and she was confused by my behavior because she was used to the angry dad, the resentful dad, the
mm-hmm.
you know, one that would express his disappointment. And so I learned that that changed my life. When I'm in situations now, I regularly ask myself the question of all the possibilities, what would do the most good?
Right. Well,
I've come to the conclusion that life is an act of creation. Every moment is an act of creation.
Mm-hmm.
What do I want to create? But
can I help,
like,
Tammy?
Yeah, what? Those are some very powerful ways of looking at life and not feeding your negativity.
Uh-huh.
I appreciate you going over that and sharing it.
Well, you're welcome.
That's very wise. I know that you just helped a ton of people by saying that, too.
Well, I hope so. I know that it changed my life when I began to explore these ways of feeding the positive wolf.
Yeah.
And
it's a very hard thing to do nowadays, to focus on the positive when there's so much negativity around us.
Well, we're inundated with negativity, aren't we?
Mm-hmm.
I mean, we're swimming in it.
Yeah.
And so one of the things that I needed to do is I stopped watching television about 10 years ago. I don't have one in my home. I stopped reading newspapers. Because what I noticed was is that what it would do is simply draw my attention to the negative things in the world, and I would lose my sense of hope or inspiration about what can be different.
Mm-hmm.
Well, you remember you did that story, Ted, that you remember one time a couple years back, you said you went to the newspaper. you decided to divide up all the columns, all to do with it as negative and positive.
Well, that's it. I used to teach a wellness class at the local college, and one of the exercises I would give students is I would say, bring a newspaper to class and a pair of scissors. And then when they got to class, I would say, the exercise is I want you to read the newspaper and clip out all the stories and put the
mm-hmm.
positive stories in one pile and the negative and fear-based stories in a second pile. And, you know, the outcome was always the same. The pile that had the positive stories was few and far between, and the other one was most of the newspaper. And then my question was, is how come when we see this, why do we constantly feed ourselves negativity day after day after day? I mean, most people do that. Most people turn on the TV and watch the news before they close their eyes at night, and the last images they see are about the worst things that human beings can do to one another.
Yeah.
And to me, you know, that makes us sick.
We're bombed by fear.
That's true. Yeah. Thank you for the information. I'll keep listening to your show.
Great. Thanks for asking.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Tammy, bye-bye. Well, Ted, we're coming to a close, and I'd like to thank you for coming on. It's been a pleasure having you here. The callers, I'd like to thank the callers for calling in, and those are listening to bbsradio.com, Between Two Worlds. All those listening into the chat room on the Pal Talk room as well. Ted's got a website also. It is called peacebeginswithme.ca. And if you want to buy Ted's book, he's got a book available on his page as well. And if you're in our area, in the Surrey, Vancouver area, you can always call him up. And if Ted's got an email address somewhere here. Let's see, what's Ted's email address? I don't have it with me.
It's T. J. Kuntz, K-U-N-T-Z, at Axion, which is AXION.net.
Okay.
So there's a link on my website. There's a contact page that says what my mailing address is and my email address.
There you go. So you can go to Ted's website, peacebeginswithme.ca. Ted, it's been a pleasure having you on.
Derek, it's always a pleasure. Thank you for the opportunity, and keep up the good work.
And, folks, if you want to buy his book or if you want to ask any more questions, you know, it doesn't hurt to give Ted a call. Go to his website, and if there's a phone number on there, give him a call, email him, talk to him. He doesn't mind talking to you, and this guy can get into your head.
And Derek, I have a free monthly newsletter that I share stories and inspiration about living peacefully. If people want to sign up, there's a place on my homepage to sign up for that.
Okay, get them to do that. Guys, sign up with Ted. He's always, like I said, he's always got something out there. Anyway, take care, Ted. It's been a pleasure having you on. I want to get you back on again next time. We got more to talk about because you've got something else you're putting out, and I love this new thing that you just finished sending to me just recently called What Keeps People Safe, and also How Martin Luther King Revolutionized America. I mean, oh boy, you guys, I'm telling you, this is the second one. I'm going to get Ted to come back here and talk about that one.
I'd be glad to.
Anyways, folks, it's been a pleasure. In the meantime, between time, that's it. This is Derek West, Guy Cloud, talking to you, speaking to you from Between Two Worlds Radio on BBSRadio.com. Take care next week, folks. Be safe and be good out there. Bye.